Welcome to the Friends with Money podcast, brought to you by Money Magazine, creating financial freedom for Australians since 1999.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Friends with Money podcast. My name is Tom Watson and I'm a journalist here at Money Magazine. And joining me today is Serena Bird, author of the Joyful Startup Guide and host of the Joyful Frugalista podcast. Serena, thanks so much for coming on today.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me as a guest.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's great to have you on. I think it's fair to say that over the past 2 years, we've all had a lot of time, at least more time than normal, to ponder the big questions in life. And for many, the pandemic has provided an opportunity to consider, you know, what people do for a living and to seriously contemplate taking that small or medium or big idea that they have and turning it into a reality via their very own side hustle or startup. Now, Serena, you're a bit of an expert on this because it's actually the basis of your new book, The Joyful Startup Guide, which I've just had the pleasure of reading over the weekend. So to start us off, for anyone out there who's perhaps thinking about starting a side hustle or a business of their own, where do they need to start? And what are some of the really practical things that they need to do to get set up?
Well, thank you so much for that introduction. And I actually just want to backtrack a little bit and say I nearly fell over when you described me as an expert because my book is very much talking about how I'm a newbie in this space. I haven't yet made it. I've made a lot of mistakes. I am still learning and I most certainly
do. You've written a book, Serena. That's experts in my books anyway.
But I do suffer from imposter syndrome and this is not uncommon. This is quite a common thing for most people, I think, particularly those who are highly passionate about an idea and have the ability to bring it to fruition, but particularly people with a startup idea, because we usually think, oh, I won't be able to do it. I can't do it. I'll never make it. And it's often when you're having those feelings that means that you are onto something pretty special and it's pretty scary because it is pretty special. And that probably means you need to do it. If that makes sense, because if you weren't thinking like that, if you weren't just a little bit scared, it's probably just ordinary. So if you're feeling a little bit scared, that's because you know this has the potential to be quite transformative. And that then means that you have to validate that and do something. But it isn't easy. And so I guess the first step in answer to your question is to take that leap and to have that courage in terms of feeling that you can do it, knowing you can do it and embracing that imperfect action. Now, imperfect action is going to look different for everyone. And it might even be just a small symbolic thing, such as, for instance, purchasing the domain name. And that's a really good place to start because while certain other things might be because you're the best qualified, when it comes to domain names on the internet, it's like Monopoly. It's all about who owns it and who gets it first. So if you've got a great name,
so you've got to get in.
Get in. And it's not that expensive. It can be anywhere between, I don't know, $13, $14 to thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, depending on your name. But you want to get in early. And you especially want to do it before you register your business name, because what often happens is that private companies that sell domain names will know who's registered what business names, and then they will buy up those domain names so they'll be more expensive. So buy the domain name first. It's usually pretty easy. There are a number of companies that can do this for you. And then you can take action with other things. And also get the accounts for social media networks that you want to use. Now, depending on your business will depend largely on which social networks you will need to use. It's really tempting to say everyone should be on different platforms, but it really does depend on the nature of your business. But for a lot of entrepreneurs these days, it's Instagram and also Facebook. And of course, they're both owned by Meta, so they are linked. So it's a good idea to have a look around, see what other names are out there and get that really cool name, even if you change your name later. But that's a really good way of owning that imperfect action and just getting that.
Those are fantastic tips. But one thing that kind of, you know, you talked about in your book and that I was thinking of is how do you even come up with just the name itself? Like I feel like it's such an important thing in some ways, but probably something that people you know, overthink or spend too much time on as well?
This is another great question. And I have a big tip regarding that, which is when you are brainstorming your ideas or brain showering your ideas, put it out to your community, like ask your friends. I have Facebook groups, so I'll ask it on a Facebook group, and I encourage people to go onto the Joyful Business Club Facebook group and ask, do you like this name? Do you not like this name? Which name and why? And creating polls is a really good way, because then you can get people to vote on them so that you can get a sense of what people resonate with. Now, obviously, you listen to your own intuition. You have a sense of what feels right. You're the one who's going to be saying that name of that business and looking at that name for a very long time to come. So you really do want to pick something that you personally like. If you're like, oh, why did I pick that name? I really hate that name. It's not going to be very fun. But that said, you want to have a sense of how that resonates and lands with other people. And so looking at your community and the feedback they give you is also really important, because that will give you a sense for what resonates and why that resonates. And I'd add to that too, that sometimes quite unexpectedly, the name that you choose might have a completely different sort of meaning or connotation that might be not be exactly, shall we say, PC. And it can be quite unintended. And so it's always good too, before you really settled on this name, that you maybe ask those in your family who are a bit cheeky to ask them, can you come up with anything with this name that is going to have an unintended kind of meaning? Let's look at abbreviating it, see what people will do. A good example of this, and I know we were talking before about you living in Canberra, we have a discount outlet here that's called the Canberra Outlet Centre. Now, that wasn't its original name. It was changed, but everyone in Canberra looks at the abbreviation for that and just laughs. And that was definitely something that was intended. Like, it's still in business. So if anyone from the Canberra Outlet Centre is listening, you know, we know who you are and we know what they do, but there's a whole other meaning colloquially that people know. And of course, there's urban slang dictionaries that you can look up and so forth. So it is really important, because people might not tell you directly to your face.
Too polite, yes.
But it could have a real impact on your brand.
Listen, I feel like I'd be an excellent kind of name tester in that respect. So maybe that's a side hustle of my own, doing outreach to business. But moving on a little bit, what about branding? Like, how do you go about establishing what your brand actually is? Because as you say in your book, it's much more than just a logo, right?
Oh, so much more than a logo. I did a good Facebook Live on this discussion with a brand expert in Melbourne called Litsa Babralagu, and then a graphic designer called Lib Ferreira. Litsa was the guest, but Lib was online and she was providing a lot of input as well. And Lib has designed the logos for me for the Joyful Fashionista and the Joyful Business Club. She's excellent and I know she knows her things. So what usually happens is that people come, oh, I've got an idea for a name. And then they usually don't ask anyone else about it. They don't do that step of checking for, you know, other meanings or what your group or community thinks of it. They just go, I've got this great name and I want it to be in red and big letters or whatever it is. And so they'll go out and maybe go on something like Fiverr, where they can get some very inexpensive designs. And Fiverr can be great like that, by the way. Fiverr can be amazing. There's another company in Australia, I think it's called 99 Designs. Or they might go onto something like Canva and they might develop them themselves. And they're increasingly more opportunities for people to do that. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, but your logo is the visual representation of your brand. And your brand is so much more than just the logo. In fact, when you are briefing your graphic designer, if it's a good graphic designer, that person will be asking you everything about your brand story and what it represents. And that's really what you need to capture. Because why someone will choose one brand over a next, sometimes it'll be price, but more often than not, it's to do with trust and that relationship of trust. And that building of trust takes time. In my book, I give the analogy of someone who's going on a first date. So before you go on the first date, you've usually got to a point where you've one party has made the other party trust them enough to actually want to go out and physically meet that person. you know, in the flesh, which is, you know, a big thing in the post-COVID world. So there's a lot of trust that has to happen before then. So usually you might have seen their profile, you might have been chatting to them, you might have been introduced by friends. There's often a bit of, I don't know, LinkedIn stalking, whatever else there is. And then you get to the date and you don't usually get married on that first date. So there's a lot of work that has to happen. So moving back into the analogy of the brand, like people usually need to see you, trust you, investigate quite a fair bit of time before they'll seal the deal. Sometimes it could be quite quick. They might just see your product on a supermarket shelf. But behind that, there would have been a lot of work before, say, the supermarket gets to trust you before they put it on the shelf. So there's a lot of work that has to happen. In my book, I give an example of how Litza says that often when she's working with clients, she'll ask them something about why they've done this business, like something really deep and passionate and personal, because for everyone, there's a why about what we do things. It's very rare that you find someone who said, oh, I just went into this business because I wanted to make money. Like usually there's a why. Like I wanted to bake pastries because it reminded me of my grandmother, what my grandmother used to bake and how important that was. You know, they were migrants from somewhere and they baked these amazing pastries. And when I bake them, I remind myself and I remember back to these smells and these flavors and these tastes that bring me back to my childhood, for instance. Or I love cleaning people's house because it's just so meaningful to see that I help them create peace and tranquility. And I just love that sense of cleanliness and I'm really into decluttering. So there'll always be a why. And so Litza says that sometimes she's actually moved to tears when she hears people's sense of why, because that then, that's the story. Like that's why they do that. And then that colours everything. And then you can think about, well, what colours do you want? What represents? What style? You know, is it something that's going to look vintage because it's reminding you of grandma? Or is it something modern because, you know, you're really into technology? Is it something green because it's aligned with climate? So, but it all comes back to that story and your why. And so you need to be really clear on all of those things before you go off and do the logo. But that said, people do often change their minds. They do often rebrand. They do often change and things are evolving. You know, even big banks like ANZ have had logo changes, or McDonald's has had a bit of an upgrade to its restaurants.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. Like we see that all the time, right? You know, that's just part of, you know, the transition over time. So the idea is that people shouldn't be kind of stuck in stone with their choices initially as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. Just as you grow as people, you know, as you grow in your life, brands will grow too. And so they will change. And from time to time, they'll need updating. However, if you get some of that strategic thinking about what you stand for and what you're about right early on, that will give you much more longevity with your brand and the messages as it flows through.
So we've talked about kind of some of the first steps you should take in terms of, you know, securing your domain name. That's my major takeaway so far, and, you know, building your brand as well. This obviously takes money, you know, to do. So in your book, you talk about creating a cash buffer before actually launching. Is there any hard and fast rule about how big that buffer needs to be? And aside from someone's own cash reserves, how else can, you know, budding businesses go about, you know, actually financing themselves?
Look, this is going to depend on a lot of factors. And I also want to say that I am someone who's coming to this from a place of privilege. I did have a good job beforehand. I had been frugal for many years. I do have assets. Worst comes to worst, I can sell some, you know, one or two of my investment properties and I'll get some money and we'll keep going. And my husband's still working in full-time employment in a very secure public service job. So I'm in a good position to do this. There are people who, say, are migrants who come to Australia for whatever reason, they can't get a full-time job or they don't want to get a full-time job, and they have to pretty much start with next to nothing. And that is really tough, and I just want to acknowledge that. In a best case scenario, you do want to have a cash buffer because things are often unexpected. Like I resigned work 3 weeks before bushfires and then we went into COVID. I had, I think, about 4 freelance writing clients before I left work, and I thought I would just build on them. And then what happened during COVID is that all of that just died, not all at once, but gradually. And so If I hadn't had a plan B of having good cash reserves, it would have been very difficult. And I'm still not where I want to be in terms of getting an income in. And I want to be clear about that because sometimes because I've written a book, you can assume that, oh, yes, she's made it and she's doing all of this. I'm still a work in progress. So definitely having some money behind you will help. The amount will be different depending on everyone because it's going to depend a lot on how frugal you are prepared to be. Or you want to be, whether you say got dependents, whether you've got kids. I do have children, but thankfully, like I said, I'm in a good financial situation. And also to how much you're going to invest in your business. Like different businesses will need different things. If you're off, opening a shop that needs stock, you've got to pay a certain amount of money. Digital platforms usually don't need as much, but it depends a lot. You might need a lot in marketing and other things. So to think, I think it's more useful to think about how much you are actually prepared to channel into the business and to think about how much you are prepared to invest, and that if things don't go well and that you don't get that back, that you're okay to walk away. Because there is a very high proportion of small businesses that won't make it. And I can't remember the statistics. They're very scary and they change all the time. But yeah, a lot don't make it. And look, that's fine if that's money that was okay to lose. And, you know, we can spend a lot of money going on a holiday overseas. At least now we can, now that restrictions are easing, or buying a new car and we don't bat an eyelid about it. There are experiences that were really worth it for us. And if following your dreams was an experience that was really worth it for you, because you'll know you'll never have regrets that you tried, like that's fine. But if you're starving to do that, that's not so fine. I don't know if I've made sense with that. But, you know, just having a sense, you know, kind of a stop loss for your business, and I guess, you know, how far you're prepared to go down and at what point you say, yeah, okay, that's enough, and you walk away. And being really clear about that, and particularly if you're in a relationship, being really clear about that in a relationship too, because I certainly know myself, I put a lot of pressure on myself wanting to be earning the same amount that I was previously feeling I needed to. Mm-hmm. Whereas my lovely husband, my lovely Neil, he was like, you know, we're fine financially. I just want to see you happy. I can see what you're doing is really meaningful. Like, you know, just chill out a bit. But having that conversation, because, you know, that's really important to have. But in terms of finding money, I guess starting out, there's broadly three main or four main ways. One is your own money. The second is investors' money. The third is grants. And I guess the fourth is sales. Now, sales is really important because sometimes I find in the sort of startup circles that I'm in, they're looking to accelerate and build big quickly. So they go sort of straight to investors. And a lot of the dialogue and the conversations are around getting angel investors or VC investors and scaling up big. But don't forget sales. Like if you are generating something that is getting money from the go-get and you don't need investors, that's even better, right? Because you've got full ownership of it. Yes, totally, right? You don't need to have a public company. It's all your baby. That said, if you are limiting your growth potential because you don't want to get investment, that's another thing, you know, you can have scarcity mindset there. But, you know, if you're able to generate sales from the go-get and expand that way, fabulous. That's really important. In my book, I say there is no better time to seek investors than now. We have a lot more interest in startups and startup potential than I think any other time in history. We've seen the phenomenal growth in tech giants, in particular in the US, and we're getting more and more comfortable with how that's happening and thinking that, yes, if people can get in as an investor early on, they can reap tremendous rewards if they're in on the ground floor. Of course, investing in startups is a high risk investment strategy, but there are increasingly people who are willing to do that. There's also a phenomenal rise in different crowdsourcing options like equity crowdfunding and other things. So there's options like Kickstarter or other programs that will allow people to invest in your company from the go-get. And there's different models with those, whether or not they're equity or they're in kind, i.e. Give me $30 now and I'll give you my book when I write it versus give me $30 and you can have a share of my company. Mm. Or give me $30 and I'll give it back to you with interest. So there are a couple of different models with that crowdfunding and crowdsourcing, but there's certainly the digital platforms are making it easier and easier for people to get money that way. And I guess the final one is grant funding. And you might be surprised, a lot of business owners don't think they're eligible for grant funding, but there are some phenomenal grants that are around if you know how to apply. I was fortunate last year to obtain two grants, one through YWCA Canberra through their Great Ideas grant. So I received $1,000, which I paid forward this year by sponsoring a grant for $2,000. So I was very grateful for that. And I've paid it forward. And then I also received an Innovation Connect, or what's often known as an ICON grant through the Canberra Innovation Network, which is from the ACT government last year. Now, I didn't think I'd get either of those, but there you go. I put in the application and I did. One person that I know, a fabulous female entrepreneur, got $500,000 to build a new headquarters for her company. So she's the organics section. And so organic sector, and she is building a new headquarters that's going to employ over 20 people in her regional area, and that's going to provide jobs for people in the organics packing and packaging space. But if you never put in that application, you will never get that money.
You've got to be in it to win it, as they so often say. Now, Serena, you touched upon sales before, and that's something that I just want to drill down into very quickly. What do people need to know about setting up an e-commerce option if they have a website, obviously, for, you know, selling goods or services? And, you know, making sure that their customers actually buy their products, because I imagine there's probably a little bit more involved than just a kind of a clicky button that, you know, helps your goods, you know, zoom towards your house kind of thing.
Well, actually, there are a lot of clicky buttons you can put in very easily now. So I'm currently working on a book on e-commerce, and I'll be honest and say this comes from having a very bad experience with paying someone a lot of money to do something that I thought was very complicated. And then when that all went haywire, I started to do it myself and became very interested in it. But certainly, once again, the digital revolution is meaning that it's easier and easier to sell things online. It's quite easy now to list things on Instagram and Facebook. In fact, you can do it pretty much at the same time because they're both owned by Meta. Some products such as Square, who do the Square readers that a lot of people purchase to sell things at markets, that's got quite good technology behind it that you can easily do a website and you can list your items. So you can be at a market and you can can easily tap on your product and they can purchase it. So that's an in-person option, but, you know, some people still buy in person. But then you can also very easily create a website, and you can also put those items on Facebook and Instagram very easily. That's just one example of one platform, but there are, in fact, many platforms. I think often what happens is people assume they need a certain platform. And it's really important to think about your business and where you're going. Are you, say, for instance, a restaurant selling fast food where people only just want to buy things very quickly on your website? They don't really want to stay. Or are you someone who's selling, say, digital services such as blog posts or coaching or something like that, where you want to draw people into your website and have them stay a long period of time because you also want them to, say, watch your YouTube channels and that you'll monetize it from that. So you've got to think about whether you want it to make it really quick and fast and easy for people so that they just come in and go, or whether you want to actually have them engaged and funneled them into other offerings and actually stay there. So once you sort of think about what kind of product or service you have and, you know, sort of how you want to do it, then it becomes quite easy then to design what you do want. One thing I will say, though, is that people often think that they need very expensive solutions, particularly expensive apps and so forth. If you design something that's mobile responsive, that's the first way there. And the other thing too is to think about things that have your MVP, your minimal viable product, before you go off and build a custom build website with all the bells and whistles. Like, just try it out. Like, it might be enough, for instance, just to have a Facebook group and just to sort of sell things in your Facebook group for a while and see if there's a bit of interest and a bit of need, or an Instagram page where you do the same. Like, if you're interested in this, DM me, whatever it is, and then build up the community. And then you can invest in the bigger technological things that will support them. We tend to think that it's a, you know, to quote that, was it a 90s movie about the baseball fields? But, you know, this build it and they'll come. But you do actually need to create the community and to really be clear about what the demand is. And in fact, you know, one thing perhaps we haven't even, I haven't even talked about too, is this need to be very clear about what your customer requirements are. One great course I did through the Canberra Innovation Network in 2020 was their Ideas to Impact course. And as part of that, we were encouraged to go out and interview 100 people. Now, I didn't make 100. I only made 35 because I'm a bit of a chatter. And so I couldn't just have simple five-minute conversations with people. I know you're laughing. You'd never guess that I like to talk, right? So I was having hour-long conversations with people. But that was really instructive. So before you spend the big money on the big technology, get something smaller working and get a sense for what people really want. And that will really help greatly in your design. And it'll also help bring people along with you when you're ready to launch.
Now, I'm conscious of time and I know you're not going to toot your own horn, Serena, but at least from my perspective, your story seems to be one of success so far. You know, you're the founder of the Joyful Frugalista, the Joyful Business Club and the Joyful Fashionista. You're, you know, a published author two times over now. You're a podcaster. You know, I could go on. But one thing I'm really interested in is along your journey, what is perhaps one mistake that comes to mind and how would you go about doing that differently with hindsight?
Oh, look, there's been many, but there's one particularly that I'll highlight and maybe a second if we have time. The first is that I lost quite a lot of money last year in developing a website. Now, I'm a believer that anything that happens to you is an opportunity for learning. The book I'm working on at the moment about e-commerce comes out of that. And when it all went down in a heap, I said, basically, learning comes in many, many forms. This isn't the form I wanted to come in, but I've learned a lot from this experience. And basically what had happened was I had done a minimum viable product of what is now the Joyful Fashionista marketplace. I'd actually built a classified site when I should have built a marketplace, but I didn't know, right? I just knew that I wanted somewhere where people could buy and sell secondhand clothing because that's my real passion. Mm. I'm really passionate about sustainability and I really wanted to make it more accessible. And the platforms that I saw that were available were mainly targeted at a very young demographic and none of the brands I like to wear or my friends like to wear were there. And I thought particularly that Generation X women had high disposable incomes and often imperfect body shapes and I wanted a platform that was inclusive for them. So I built my own site and I had it audited and there were a few issues. And so I went to a trusted friend and she looked at it. She said, yeah, I'll work on that for you. And then she thought a bit more and she said, no, but Serena, I think what you need is you actually need a custom built site. And I perhaps could have got a second opinion at that stage, but I didn't. I then took on her opinion and her reference to a website developer who was offshore. Now, was working with him. She knew him very well. Another friend I knew him very well. So I've got two people I trust who know this person. So I'm thinking, yeah, that's fine. So the big takeaway here is what I should have done was what my husband has now told me was a catchphrase in his work, which is trust is fine, checking is better. What I should have done was ask them for examples of work that was in the similar genre to what I'd done. But because I had been told that they'd been working on big projects, and because at the time I didn't really have much faith in my own technical ability, I thought I didn't really understand or know things, which was probably true. When they said they could do this and when they said they knew what I was talking about, I just trusted that. It was a long process that took all up about 7 months. I lost a lot of money over it. And in the end, what they produced was not functional at all. And it was also a very negative experience because it was horrid and it was emotionally very difficult for me. It was very difficult for my own mental health as well. And I had to struggle to get my own domain names and URLs out there. And in the end, none of the coding was any good and I had to work from scratch. So that all sort of went down on a Wednesday and I had a big event on a Friday and by Sunday I started to rebuild. And I can't say it's easy. Wow, it's not where I wanted it to be yet, but I just want to acknowledge too that not everyone has necessarily has that resilience to do that. Like a lot of people will, something like that will happen and they'll just be devastated and they'll walk away. And there are unfortunately a lot of unscrupulous operators, and especially when it comes to women in business, they just assume that you don't know what you're doing, especially with tech, and people will take advantage of that.
So a harsh lesson, but one that you got over the other side of, which is fantastic as well. Serena, I feel like we could talk for ages, and you know, I'd totally recommend your book for anyone that's been slightly piqued by today's conversation. But we are going to have to leave it there. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on. So thank you, and I'm sure we'll do it again soon too, if you can.
Thank you so much for having me.
And don't forget that if you enjoy listening to Friends with Money, we'd love you to recommend it to your own friends and family, or you can help us out by leaving a review on iTunes or the Apple Podcast app. You can also send in any questions, comments, or even topics you'd like us to cover to our dedicated email, which is podcast@moneymag.com.au. And last but not least, make sure you head over to moneymag.com.au for all the latest financial news and stories, including articles from both Serena and myself, I should say. That's it for this episode of the Friends with Money podcast. I'm Tom Watson. Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Friends with Money podcast. For credible, independent, and easy to understand financial commentary, visit moneymag.com.au. Please remember that the views and opinions expressed in this podcast are general in nature, and further independent advice and research based on your personal circumstances should be sought before making an investment decision.